You all are ready.
You ready?
Our clerk will call the final case on our oral argument docket for today.
The court will now call Stephen Valdez versus the state of Texas. The mayor, please, the court. Mrs. Chris Cable, sorry for the appellate, and Ms. Andrea Simmons, sorry for the state.
Mr. Abel.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name's Chris Abel from town of Flower Mound, and I'm here today representing Mr. Stephen Billicke, the appellant in this case. Thank you for having me. Mr. Billicke was indicted for a murder charge in Denton County, proceeded to trial before a jury in the 362nd District Court, was convicted of that murder and subsequently sentenced to 65 years, Texas Department of Criminal Justice. This case all stemmed from an incident involving Mr. Billicke snapping one day. He had gone throughout his entire life with no criminal history, lost his job at American Airlines, his wife left him and moved in with some people he didn't care for. He began to drink and one night snapped. While intoxicated, he left his house with a gun, drove to several convenience stores, made some phone calls to various people, and then happened upon Mr. Johansson, the victim in this case. It's not quite clear everything that was said between Mr. Johansson and appellant, although there were some words and involved a lot of profanity from appellant to Mr. Johansson. It was possibly a fight over whether or not he could borrow Mr. Johansson's phone. It's not quite clear, but at some point he followed Mr. Johansson down I-35 and shot him in the head. Mr. Johansson died, and that led to the murder conviction, the trial, and subsequent conviction of appellant.
Mr. Abel, am I correct that the first time that Mr. Johansson and Mr. Billicke met was at the convenience store?
Yes, Your Honor, it seems to be that way. I guess it's possible that they had interactions before.
That they met any other place or ever knew each other before the time in which they were put together by
correct.
Fate in that convenience store.
Yes, sir. I mean, this is being at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mr. Johansson was a stranger to Mr. Billicke.
Yes, sir.
Time of this incident.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. If they ever met beforehand, no one knows about that, and it certainly didn't come into trial.
All right, so, thank you.
Yes, sir. During trial, several things happened, though, however, which is why appellant is here today arguing before this court, particularly with regards to a few things at trial. Number one, Mr. Billicke is complaining of the fact that a couple of times during trial, his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and not present evidence against himself or be compelled to testify was abrogated by the state. On one instance, it happened during the cross-examination of defense expert witness Dr. Christy Compton, who had interviewed the defendant and testified in the punishment phase of trial that Mr. Billicke suffered from some mental illnesses and certainly was diagnosed as borderline personality disorder. During the cross-examination of Dr. Compton, counsel for the state was asking questions to her and basically made the comment of, well, only one person really knows the truth about that with regards to something that appellant had told the doctor. Counsel for appellant objected, asked for a mistrial after that objection was ultimately, after that objection was ultimately sustained. There was an objection. I think at first it was overruled by trial court, but then the state asked to approach. There was a subsequent conversation. The court reversed its ruling, sustained it, instructed the jury to disregard, and then appellant moved for mistrial, which was denied. But certainly appellant's contention before this court is that his Fifth Amendment rights to remain silent, to be free from compulsion to testify, was abrogated by the state's remark, drawing attention to the fact that there was evidence potentially missing that only the appellant could supply via his testimony. And so we're here before the court today asking to look at that point, certainly, with regards to whether or not he's worthy of having a reversal of his punishment rendered in this case.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again.
Yes, Your Honor.
How did expert witness Compton become involved in this case?
She was retained via appointment and funds procured by Denton County. She was retained by defense counsel's request to do that psychological evaluation of appellant at that time.
She was originated by a defense request and was a defense witness.
Yes, Your Honor. Testified on behalf of defendant at punishment.
Only in punishment.
Only in punishment, yes, Your Honor, not during guilt, innocence at all. There was no defense raised by appellant with regards to culpable mental state during guilt, innocence at trial, with regards to insanity or anything like that. The basic defense that appellant had was that this was not knowing and intelligent, therefore not murder, so it must be manslaughter and reckless at that point. His mental state was an issue, definitely, during trial with regards to mens rea, but Dr. Compton did not opine about the guilt, innocence, nor testify during guilt, innocence at all. It was purely a punishment defense witness. Looking at that, we know, however, that the Fifth Amendment right, though sustained, the question would be whether the curative instruction was proper and was it enough to cure any kind of error or defect that happened based on that cross-examination, and we would submit to this court that it wasn't. That would be such certainly a constitutional violation, which under 44.2a would make this court have to remand this case back for a new punishment trial unless it could determine beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the punishment sentence. We believe that it did. It certainly drew attention to the fact that something that only appellant could have testified to. It drew attention to the fact that appellant did not testify during guilt, innocence, or punishment, and therefore we believe it's worthy of a new trial. It also occurred again, however, later on in trial when the same prosecutor made an improper jury argument during punishment and certainly abrogated my client's rights with regards to a fair punishment verdict in that regard as well. During closing arguments for punishment, the prosecutor referred definitely to capital punishment and that there were certainly good arguments to be made as to why appellant should receive the death penalty in this case, even though it was not a capital murder and not eligible for that. Again, there was an objection lodged by appellant and an instruction given. However, we don't believe that under Jackson v. State, any reference to a capital sentence in a non-capital case is proper. It doesn't fit any of the four areas of proper jury argument, and that certainly any kind of curative instruction would not have been enough to unring that bell. When a prosecutor stands before court, a seasoned prosecutor, and stands up there and says that there are great reasons why if you take a life, your life should be taken as well, that invocation of such an eye for an eye type of argument in front of a jury on a non-capital case is clearly improper. And certainly, it's hard to unring that bell in the minds of the jury. They gave him a pretty hefty sentence here of 65 years. And I think that that's partly due to that aggressive argument style. We believe that appellant's rights for that punishment hearing were abrogated as well there, and certainly believe that he's worthy of a new punishment trial with regards to that, free of an improper jury argument. But there were several other things that happened during guilt innocence. I've talked about punishment. During guilt innocence, however, there were several other objections lodged by appellant, which were overruled, and evidence was allowed in that we believe was overly prejudicial, such as autopsy and hospital photos depicting Mr. Johansson in the hospital, hooked up to medical equipment, and also pictures of his dissected brain from the autopsy that were allowed into evidence. There were color photographs that were allowed in, posthumous, as well as photographs of him at the hospital that certainly depict him being treated on for various injuries that are very sympathetic to Mr. Johansson and very prejudicial to appellant.
Wasn't there just one injury here?
Yes, Your Honor, he received one gunshot wound to the head, and he probably had some other injuries because he wrecked his car as well after being shot.
Well, but the issue before the court and the trial evidence presented was all to one bullet shot near his right ear.
Yes, sir. Goes in the ear and then ricochets around and certainly causes brain injury, which ultimately led to his demise.
I didn't understand that the bullet exited. It was still in his head, wasn't it?
I think it had lodged in the soft tissue around his neck somewhere, I believe. But it was still, yes, up in that head area. It had never, there was no exit wound. It came in through an ear, ricocheted around internally, caused great brain damage.
How should the trajectory of the bullet be determined but for the examination of the injury path inside the head?
Certainly the testimony of the medical examiner could suffice for that without being of a graphic nature and not being overly prejudicial. Furthermore, I don't believe the probative value is all that great because his method of death was not contested by appellant in any way. The cause of death wasn't contested. Even appellant being the shooter wasn't contested by appellant. The main issue is certainly if you look at At trial counsel's closing argument, trial counsel pretty much stipulated in closing argument that Mr. Billicke was the shooter. Mr. Hansen died as a result of that shooting. But her main argument to the jury was that this was not knowing or intentional, but was rather reckless, and therefore should constitute something other than murder. And certainly she argued for the lesser included on that. But since the probative value is very minimal here, with cause of death not being in dispute, this case is pretty similar to prior holding in Pribble, which in Pribble, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that autopsy photos used in that case, which showed dissection of some victims, basically throat muscles, esophagus, and trachea, those pictures were inadmissible. They were overly prejudicial, certainly more prejudicial than probative, because the cause of death was not disputed in that case. And we believe this is fairly similar to Pribble in that regard. Since cause of death not disputed, there was no reason that these autopsy photos were needed. And certainly there were, there was the ability of the state to call the medical examiner, which they did, and provide the testimony of cause of death if they needed to go into that. And they did without need for these pictures. These pictures were simply cumulative in that regard and certainly more prejudicial than probative. And so counsel believes that, appellant believes that that certainly contributed to his guilty verdict by inflaming the jury. And that's the reason we have 403 to do that balancing test and determine the need. There simply was no need for the proponent of that evidence to use those photographs when the testimony of the medical expert would have sufficed.
But even if you're correct, what's your harm analysis?
Well, the harm, I mean, it's not a constitutional harm, so it's not a constitutional harm analysis. So we look to see if a substantial right of appellants was violated and if the error had a substantial injurious effect or influence on the jury's verdict. At that point in time, we would look to the record as a whole to determine whether there's a substantial amount of evidence against him and whether, absent this, he still would have been found guilty. I believe that's a difficult thing to say, that absent this, he would have been found guilty, when we have such inflammatory or graphic evidence presented at that point in time. It certainly paints a negative picture, provides great sympathy for Mr. Johansson and great prejudice against appellant when being presented a photo of a dissected brain. I believe the harm's great and therefore is worthy of a result of a reversal in that regard.
Talking about harm related to guilt or innocence in this part of your discussion.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, sorry, I started with punishment. Now I'm in guilt innocence. I probably should have done it the other way around. I've never been all that great at organization.
Was there a single photograph, autopsy photograph, or was it more than one?
It was more than one photo, Your Honor. There were several from, I think, three total from the autopsy.
Of a dissected brain?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Brain wasn't dissected. They brought the brain out of the helmet, out of the head, and showed the brain independent of other parts of his body in terms of showing how it might have been bruised and the consequence of the way of the bullet path.
Yes, sir. A removed brain, I guess, from how it was. Yes, sir. Another part of the trial during guilt innocence related to the phone calls. I mentioned when I started with a brief recitation of the facts, Mr. Billicke had gone to several convenience stores before he ultimately met up with Mr. Johansson. He went to several convenience stores and placed some phone calls. Those phone calls were made to the people that his wife was staying with, the Kegleys. Appellant, for various reasons, did not like the Kegleys at all, especially Bill Kegley, and that was evidence was presented to the jury about that. But he called, made vulgar comments, threats of abuse to Mr. Kegley, basically threatened to kill him and his family. He made several calls on his way, possibly to McKinney, maybe to kill Kegley. Appellant objected to those and said, well, that's extraneous. It's certainly ancillary and has nothing to do with how he ultimately met Mr. Johansson and ended up having words with Mr. Johansson. Certainly the state argued that it was worthy of coming in front of the jury because it went to motive. But the motive in this case really has nothing to do with Mr. Kegley. Had he killed Mr. Kegley, obviously that's great evidence of motive. When someone says, I'm going to come and kill you, and then they kill you, that's, you know, pretty elementary there. But he didn't go after Mr. Kegley. He ended up with Mr. Johansson, an innocent stranger that he met up with that night. Certainly those phone calls, the graphic nature and the content of them, the threats to the Kegleys, had nothing to do with Mr. Johansson. They weren't necessary. They didn't provide absolute evidence that they needed to fill in some gaps or anything like that, and kind of contextual history that they needed with Mr. Johansson. Mr. Johansson was a complete stranger that happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And certainly, there's no kind of transfer of motive there. There's no, that's a big leap to say, because I want to go out and kill Mr. Kegley, who I hate, and therefore going to kill somebody who I've just met, Mr. Johansson. That's a hard leap to make. Those phone calls came into evidence. The contents of the phone calls did, and certainly we believe that violates Rule 403, as the prejudicial effect substantially outweighs its probative value being minimal, as the Kegleys weren't victims of this offense. They might have been victims of terroristic threat in Collin County, but certainly not of murder in Denton. Mr. Johansson was the victim. We believe that it in no way went towards his motive to kill Mr. Johansson. Whatever motive appellant had to Mr. Johansson was solely independent of that. But I'll yield. I'm out of time now, unless there's a question, and I'll yield my yield this microphone over to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Abel. Ms. Simmons?
Thank you, Chris. May it please the court, counsel, Andrea Simmons on behalf of the state. As Mr. Abel correctly said, this case was the murder of a stranger, and it was a needless act that resulted out of appellant's anger that night. And there were a lot of issues that were raised on appeal by appellant. The first that Mr. Abel addressed was the appellant's assertion of his right against self-incrimination. And the court would just reiterate that this was, in fact, the appellant's witness that testified, Dr. Compton, and then, in fact, Dr. Compton was testifying as to statements made to her by appellant. She then had a diagnosis that she gave an opinion of based upon the statements that appellant made to her. The record and evidence showed that although he had had some prior mental health diagnosis, such as depression and anxiety, there was a new diagnosis made by Dr. Compton of regarding her bipolar or disorder, personality disorder. And the state's cross-examination basically was to Dr. Compton that your diagnosis and your opinion that his failure to remember the facts of that night are based on what he's told you and no other evidence. He's the only one that knows what really happened. Your opinion isn't based on any other evidence other than what you've been told. And the state's argument is that that is a fair question on cross-examination of his witness, and that, in fact, he has been able to testify through that witness and then is attempting to limit the state's cross-examination by raising his right against self-incrimination. And so the state would argue that there was no comment made on the appellant's right to remain silent and that the question was proper. Regarding appellant's second issue that he referred to during argument this morning was the improper jury argument by referring to the death sentence during closing. In fact, the prosecutor did begin down a path of discussing that death was an appropriate punishment in this case, and there was quickly an objection. And once we got through the instruction to the jury, and we got back to closing argument, the prosecutor quickly responded what the correct punishment range was in this case.
Objection was sustained.
Yes. Yes, the objection was sustained. And it was error, and the state concedes that it was error. However, the prosecutor then went back to the jury after their instruction to disregard and told them what the proper punishment range was in the facts of this case, and then did urge for there to be for the jury to come back with the highest range of punishment. But the state would argue that the prosecutor took corrective action on his error. The jury was instructed to disregard, and there's no evidence that they did not disregard that. Furthermore, the instruction regarding the proper punishment range was included in the jury charge. So the jury again was re-informed of that proper punishment range during their deliberations. And in fact, they came back with a punishment of 65 years, when the high end of that was no more than 99 years or life, which is what the state was advocating for. And so even though there may have been error, or there was error in the prosecutor's statement, the state would argue that it was harmless and that it was corrected, and that the evidence within the record supported the punishment of 65 years, and that it was any error was corrected. The next issue raised by appellant this morning is regarding the photographs. And there were two different sections of photographs that were admitted. There were five photographs of Mr. Johansson at the ICU unit. Appellant conceded that one of those would have been admissible to for identification purposes, but objected to the remainder of those photographs that basically just show Mr. Johansson from different angles in the ICU unit with medical equipment on his face and in his mouth. The state would argue that the evidence was probative to show the was relevant to show the injuries sustained, and the probative value of these photographs was not outweighed by substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And secondly, the autopsy photographs were apparently very relevant to what was happening in this case. The medical examiner was testifying that the bullet entered the right ear and then the trajectory went down through, I believe, the throat, kind of bounced around, came back up through the skull, hit the brain, and then rested at the soft tissue of the base of the neck or skull. And by removing the top portion of the skull, they were able to then show the brain in the photographs that indicated there was discoloration, which was a result of bruising from the trajectory of the bullet having striking the brain, as well as damage done to the brain where fractures of the skull also occurred and tissue was broken from the brain. And so,
respond to Mr. Abel's argument that the Pribble case applies in this case. How do you distinguish that case when, in fact, the issue wasn't whether this defendant shot this man and that resulted in his death? That really wasn't the issue.
The state's response to that would be that autopsy photographs, when they're relevant to the cause of death, which is an issue that the state must prove, and the autopsy photographs are relevant under plenty of other case law when it's tracking and giving a physical depiction of the description of the cause of death through the testimony. So these photographs were merely giving a physical look to the jury of the descriptions that the medical examiner is giving.
I understand that there's a lot of cases that say you can do that, but how do you distinguish the specific case that he brought to this court's attention?
I do not have a response for exactly on point as to the case of Pribble. I would be glad to offer a brief, a short brief on that if this court would like me to distinguish it. So I would definitely do that, but I would still continue to rely on my brief for the propositions of other court opinions that have held that it is admissible and relevant, and also argue that the photographs also were not, the prejudicial value was not substantially outweighed by any prejudicial effect. Moving on to the extraneous offense evidence regarding the Kegleys, the state argues that this evidence was relevant and it was admissible as background evidence. These extraneous offenses most importantly went to identification, and they also went to appellant's state of mind on the night in question. There are lots of witnesses throughout the night that can tell you, give you a physical description of the person at convenience stores who may have been acting erratically, who was using store telephones and cursing at someone, threatening to kill people, and they all had a physical description of him and sometimes of his vehicle. And absent the evidence of the Kegleys, what you have is a person matching a certain description who is traveling throughout different cities at convenience stores making these threats on a phone and ultimately killing after he's followed Mr. Johansson, ultimately killing Mr. Johansson, which at some point would leave the jury with the question of what was wrong, what was going on between Mr. Johansson and the appellant. Because the inference there, it would be that he was threatening to kill Mr. Johansson because he ultimately did in fact kill Mr. Johansson. When the truth of the fact is that throughout the night, appellant was traveling to various stores making phone calls to Bill Kegley. He was threatening to kill Bill Kegley, his son, his wife, and he used multiple convenience stores phones for that purpose. While he was in those stores, he was acting erratically. He scared other patrons. And at one point, several witnesses observed this man who had a they gave a description of arguing with a man in a PT Cruiser. They all observed then the P2 Cruiser leave. The other man in the silver SUV took chase, and then within minutes they saw police and ambulances and fire trucks heading down 35. They all went to the scene to find out who, if it was the guy that they just saw, and they were able to say, yes, that gentleman just had an argument with a man by this description. Who ties that man to the description of what everybody else saw is Bill Kegley saying, and at the time, at these approximate times, he was at these locations calling me. I recognize his voice, that was him. The police can then go back and talk to witnesses and look at surveillance video, and based on the timeline Mr. Kegley gave, identify that the man matching that description was in fact appellant. And so the state would argue that those were absolutely admissible and relevant to the case at hand and helped the jury have a better understanding of the facts that night that resulted in the death that were that resulted in his guilty verdict. The final issue raised by appellant on his brief, which he did not have time to address, I'm sure he will, is the Miranda issue. In the Miranda issue, the record is clear that once the first responding officer arrived at appellant's home and an appellant was outside, the officer asked him to approach him. Appellant was very slow to respond and then began to make furtive movements towards his waist or pocket area. Officer Duke Lee was aware that the man that he was approaching had been identified as a person having a gun. And he had just left a convenience store, was yelling he was a rock star, showed a woman his gun. Store clerk had called 911, and so he was aware that the man was armed. And so he, based on that, became concerned for his own safety, drew his service revolver and ordered him to the ground and handcuffed him and asked the appellant, do you have the gun? Do you have a gun on you? And he said, no, the gun is in my car. And so at that point, he had not been Mirandized, but the state would argue for officer safety. Clearly, he was able to ask that one question to determine whether or not his safety was in jeopardy, and that the answer to that question would have come in for under the exception for officer safety. In fact, the gun was later recovered from the vehicle, and that was done pursuant to a search warrant for the vehicle. So the gun was not taken into evidence pursuant to the statement at issue. In conclusion, the state would argue that the appeal before this court, this is a very difficult case, and I believe that the evidence here was overwhelming in the record. It was replete with evidence of multiple witnesses who could identify the physical description of the person involved, and each of those physical descriptions was then matched to the timeline provided by Bill Kegley, which placed appellant going to multiple convenience stores, threatening to kill, scaring other customers before threatening ultimately and cursing at the victim in the case before chasing him down the access road of I-35 where he then shot him in the head. It was a needless crime, and we believe the state has not made any error in this case. We would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons. Mr. Abel, you have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The state just told us that the evidence was substantial in this case, and certainly it was, that appellant fired the shots that killed Mr. Johansson, or at least the shot that killed Mr. Johansson, and there was overwhelming evidence that he was indeed the shooter. That being the case, there really was no need to bring in all the phone calls with the Kegleys or their graphic nature or contents. We believe that that was overly prejudicial. Certainly it outweighed substantially any probative value that it had. Identity was not contested in this, nor were the actions of appellant. The only thing that was contested by appellant was culpable mens rea. That being the case, there really was no need, and it didn't provide a necessary backdrop to the state's theory of the case at all with regards to the graphic nature and the contents of those phone calls with the Kegleys. We believe that the court should have ruled those inadmissible under 403, and we believe that it overly inflamed the jury and therefore is worthy of reversal. And for those reasons, we would ask that this court remand this case back for a new trial, both for guilt, innocence, and for punishment. If there aren't any questions by the court, that's pretty much all I have by way of rebuttal, and my parking meter is about to expire.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I think it did. Probably, all right. Thanks.
Thank you both so much for your arguments here today. We appreciate you coming down from Benton. Your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court.
All right.